You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I am very excited to be joined live on the phone by Chris Hedges, award-winning, Pulitzer-winning columnist and writer, writing at truthdig.com, and coming to Spokane this upcoming March 10th at the Bing Crosby Theater to talk about his newest book, Wages of Rebellion. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm good, thank you.
And let me make sure we can hear you here through the phone and all. We have a very interesting setup rigged here today, but I'm glad to be talking to you. I just want to start a little summary of your new book, Wages of Rebellion, talking about how we are, again, as in many times in history, riding the crest of a revolutionary epic, from the Arab Spring to movements against austerity in Greece to the Occupy movement. In Wages of Rebellion, Chris Hedges, who has chronicled the malaise and sickness of a society in terminal moral decline in previous books, investigates what social and psychological factors cause revolution, rebellion, and resistance. What led you through your past books and writing to this specific topic now at this moment, and what do you hope people get out of this newest book?
Well, I've written about the political and social and cultural and economic system we live under in books such as Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, The Triumph of Spectacle, Death of the Liberal Class, which talked about how those bodies or institutions within our society that once made piecemeal and incremental reform possible no longer function. As well as my last book, which I did with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, where we went into the poorest pockets of the United States, Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, the coal fields of southern West Virginia, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, the Lakota Sioux Reservation, where the average life expectancy for a male is 48, and where at any one time 60% of the residents have neither electricity or running water, and the produce fields in Florida, where we see periodically examples where law enforcement authorities will uncover, virtually a slave operation where workers in the produce fields are being held against their will and not paid. So the idea was in the last book to look at these sacrifice zones, these places that had been sacrificed. So let's say in the case of the coal fields, apartment buildings or used car lots can leave their lights on all night while we are turning the Appalachian Mountains into a toxic waste dump. With former manufacturing centers, which have now descended into decay and poverty. And, of course, this whole sort of project of exploitation began with Western expansion and the decimation of Native Americans. And it really said, we live in an age of unfettered, unregulated capitalism, which is Karl Marx understood as a revolutionary force. And it behooves us to look at these sacrifice zones and what's happened because we're all rapidly becoming a sacrifice zone. So this book really builds on those last three, and no longer am I attempting to make the argument that this kind of corporate coup d'etat, which has taken place and rendered the citizen impotent, I no longer attempt to lay out the features and examples that describe that thesis, and instead look at rebellion, what it costs, how the state responds, what it takes, and I include the reflections of people who have risen up and rebelled against the corporate state in the book, including long interviews with people such as Julian Assange from WikiLeaks, who has taken refuge now in the for over 2 years in the embassy. Mumia Abu Jamal, a great Black Panther leader who's now being held with a life sentence in a prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania. Jeremy Hammond, the hacker, and others, and it attempts to describe the nature of rebellion, the responses that we can expect, the kind of mechanics of rebellion. Mm-hmm. So that's sets that book in a way apart from the other three books that are more an examination of the system.
Sure, and that's perfectly timed, I think, in a lot of ways. My introduction to your work was with Empire of Illusion. I was graduating from high school and felt this kind of vague distaste for pretty much everything going on, and it really helped, jumpstart this analysis of what's going on, living in a society where there's no critical analysis. I think you've really gone through those topics with a lot of detail, and I've spent most of the last 3 years of doing this show looking at conditioning, public relations, coercion, manipulation, social control. And now I think we're at this point where it's really urgent that we undo those things and explore how do we undo all this conditioning to make room for something new and vibrant and functional, which I think you could probably agree is what a revolution would be comprised of. In the summary of the book, it talks about this question, what are the social and psychological factors that cause revolution, rebellion, and resistance? Without spoiling the book, what are those? Like, is it just the urgency of living in a dire situation in a sacrifice zone like that, or is there something else that happens on an individual level that kind of pushes people
There's several components to revolt, which historians have looked at throughout human history. It's pretty universally agreed that movements for seismic social change or revolutions are not carried out by the poor. This was something that Marx understood. But more by those whose expectations of what a society would offer them, both economically, politically, and socially, are being thwarted. And revolutions seem to inevitably arise when there's been a preceding period of economic expansion and an opening up of civil liberties, and then that economic expansion contracts and the state becomes more draconian in terms of its forms of control. I mean, Greece is a kind of perfect example. And Greece is also an example, and I think this is what is feared, Germany and many in the EU. It can trigger what these historians call revolutionary waves. So let's say the Greek government, which, this may very well happen, will withdraw from the euro, and many members of the new ruling Greek party have a Marxist orientation, and are not seeking to accommodate themselves to a system of global capitalism, but to sever themselves from it. What will the effect of this be in Spain, where you have 25% unemployment? What will this effect be in Italy? What will this effect be in Portugal and everywhere else? And that is, interestingly enough, kind of how these revolutionary movements throughout history have this amazing rippling effect. So, for instance, you have the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and the Haitian uprising, the only successful slave revolt in human history, all sort of coming one after the other. And people forget that that revolutionary ferment was very strong in countries such as England under the Pitt government. The British government managed to successfully quell it, and part of that was the exiling of Thomas Paine, who had played a fundamental role through Common Sense and his writings in the American Revolution, and then was doing the same thing in Britain. He was he fled to France and became a deputy in the National Assembly, one of only two foreign deputies, and then, of course, denounced the Reign of Terror and is in prison. But, I mean, here you have in a figure one who kind of embodied that kind of migration in his own life, and that's what happens. So it's, you know, important to understand that when systems are seized by a tiny oligarchy, whether that is a nobility or a small group of military figures, or in our case, corporate oligarchs, essentially what happens is you create a system of political paralysis where the government no longer responds nor is capable of responding to the needs of citizens. And that becomes very dangerous. That's something, for instance, that I saw in the former Yugoslavia, where after Tito died, you had in essence, let's call it a kind of liberal government in terms of outlook. But because, especially after the Cold War, and Yugoslavia no longer occupied that position as a buffer state, they were saddled with tremendous debt. They couldn't service that debt. I think it was $9 billion. The economy collapsed. The state-run enterprises could no longer be sustained. Hyperinflation swept through the country. And that self-identified kind of democratic liberal elite that was nominally in charge of the country was unable to respond to what was happening to the citizenry. And that gave rise, that kind of collapse, it vomited up these figures like Slobodan Milosevic and Radovan Karadzic and Franjo Tuđman and others, in much the same way that Weimar collapsed and vomited up the Nazi Party. So here we have in the United States a situation where half the country now lives in a category which is officially described as either poverty or near poverty. People are, I forget what the exact figure is now, but, you know, well over 6 million people have been evicted from their homes because mm-hmm. of foreclosures, bank repossessions. Despite all the Potemkin statistics you read, unemployment and chronic underemployment has made life extremely difficult mm-hmm. for the working poor. Our unemployment figures are a fiction because, of course, when you stop looking for work after 6 weeks, you're no longer counted as unemployed. Mm-hmm. And if you have a part-time job, and the average worker at Walmart works about 28 hours a week, but your wages still put you below the poverty line, you're counted as employed. And it's a great system for the Walton family, which makes about $11,000 an hour. I think that's right.
That sounds right. And they
hand out, you know, food stamp applications to their workers because they qualify. So it's this kind of bizarre system where the U.S. government is subsidizing the Walton fortune. You have a situation of, you know, unsustainable student debt, mm-hmm. and this expanding military apparatus that is hollowing the country out from the inside. So resources go towards the maintenance and expansion of empire. Meanwhile, schools and libraries, firehouses are closed. Bridges and roads are crumbling. Our public transportation, especially our train system, is, compared to Europe or Japan or anywhere else, a joke. And social services are being cut in the name of austerity. So this is a very similar, though not as advanced in terms of its reach as what's happening in Greece, but it's a very similar mm-hmm. kind of problem. So, you know, we are as vulnerable now as anyone else because the mechanisms by which we once made reform possible, whether through the courts, the legislative branch, no longer work. They don't respond to the needs of citizenry. In fact, they permit global capitalists on Wall Street to loot the U.S. Treasury to the tune of, I think it's $17 trillion now or something. And it's a system that's not sustainable. And it, you know, what usually what happens is that there is some kind of a crisis, whether that is precipitated by the collapse of the economy again, and all the Wall Street speculators are right back in business with taxpayer money. So that even kind of very sober business reporters like Gretchen Morgenson at the New York Times are talking about the inevitability of another collapse or a climate crisis or something else. So we're kind of set up now for a period of revolutionary ferment for a backlash. That backlash could very well be a right-wing backlash. We have a very strong kind of proto-fascist force within this country, embodied in the Christian right, in the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, and militia groups and everything else. And those populist or radical groups, which were actually ascendant on the eve of World War I, the old Wobblies, the old CIO, even the Communist Party, powerful labor, they've all been eviscerated and destroyed, largely in the name of anti-communism. So something's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Where we're going to go, how it's going to play out, whether that will result in a much more naked form of authoritarianism, those are unanswered questions. But it seems pretty clear across the political spectrum, and I think this is why Congress has a 9% approval rating, that the system's just not working. It's not working for anybody unless, you're fabulously rich and, inside Citibank mm-hmm. or ExxonMobil or one of these other corporations. I mean, really, at the bottom line, there's no interest or no possibility within the political system to vote against the interests of corporations like Goldman Sachs. You can't do it.
Yeah. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis talking with Chris Hedges about upcoming talk here in Spokane about the new book, Wages of Rebellion. That will be at the Bing Crosby Theater March 10th at 7 p.m. You can find information about it at www.peacejustice.org/hedges. You can also find it by finding this podcast on kyrs.org under the show page Praxis. I want to go back to something you mentioned. You mentioned this historical pattern of unsavory folks and ideas filling that power vacuum that's left in these systemic collapses. And I tend to agree that the most well-organized or well-supported memes and figures are this proto-fascist far-right, are these characters. What about that is working, and what about maybe more progressive, a lot of words I don't really like to use, but we don't have other words for what I'm trying to express, progressive, more traditionally left, what is lacking there? Is it a type of organization that is not working? Is it a communication problem? Like, what's your assessment of that? I know you write about it in Death of the Liberal Class, but what is the right doing that is working better?
Well, the right is doing what all fascist movements do, and it's channeling a very legitimate rage towards the vulnerable. So as people feel trapped and frustrated and struggle with despair and economic insecurity and joblessness or wages that make it impossible to sustain an income, or, you know, sustain a lifestyle that is free from economic insecurity, you channel that rage towards Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, liberals, feminists, intellectuals. I mean, they have, you know, they have a very long list of people they hate, and that's classic fascism. And you also sacralize the symbols of the nation in the name of traditional Christianity. So that fusion of the iconography and the language of patriotism and religion, which was, you know, kind of what happens in totalitarian movements, and the demonization of the vulnerable, funnels that anger, in, ironically, towards the weakest members of society, and people, and they vent against those members as if those groups within the society are responsible for the decline. And what happens is that often the very forces that in fact are responsible for the decline, the Koch brothers and others, are funneling finances and resources into these proto-fascist movements in the same way that German businessmen were funneling resources into the Nazi Party. And unfortunately, the right wing in the United States is far more pervasive and far more powerful than the left. That's not the fault of the left, because the left in this country was destroyed. As I write in Death of the Liberal Class, the liberal establishment was never designed to be the political left. The liberal establishment in a capitalist democracy is designed as a kind of safety valve, so that, for instance, when capitalism breaks down in the 1930s, Roosevelt, who's a classic liberal, gives us the New Deal. And as Roosevelt says correctly, his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. But the assault on all of those radical movements, whether it was the Progressive Party or you know, the Wobblies or anyone else, and the destruction of those movements by right-wing corporate forces essentially destroyed the mechanism by which you could adjust and ameliorate and respond to the grievances of the underclass, and the political system kind of seized up. And so what you get, and this again goes back to what I mentioned in Yugoslavia, is this kind of faux liberalism embodied in figures like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, who speak in that traditional feel-your-pain language of liberalism, and yet assiduously serve corporate power. So, you know, under Clinton, you get NAFTA in 1994, which was the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the Taft-Hartley Act of 1948, which made it very hard to unionize. You get the destruction of welfare, and we must not forget that under the old welfare system, 70% of the recipients were children. You get the omnibus crime bill, which explodes, you know, pumps money to build prisons and create the prison industrial complex. So by the time Clinton is finished, the prison population has soared to up to 2 million. This is all Clinton. You get the deregulation of the FCC, which is not a small issue, so that the airwaves are essentially turned over to a half dozen huge corporate entities: Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Clear Channel, and then of course you get the destruction of Glass-Steagall, which set up a firewall between investment and commercial banks. It means your local bank, which took your money and had your pension fund, couldn't become a hedge fund, and that's why Canada doesn't have a banking crisis, because they never ripped down those firewalls. But we did. And Clinton understood that if he did corporate bidding, he'd get corporate money. So that by the 90s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and when Obama ran in 2008, he actually got more money. And Obama has continued that tradition. In fact, you know, Obama's assault on civil liberties has been far more egregious than the assault under George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
The constant use of the Espionage Act, which is the equivalent of Britain's Foreign Secrets Act, it was never designed to shut down whistleblowers who were attempting to inform the citizenry about malfeasance and criminal activity and fraud within government. It was designed to prosecute those who gave secrets to foreign governments that were considered hostile to the United States. So that act was passed in 1917. Between 1917 and between January 2009, when Obama comes to power, it's used three times against whistleblowers, including against Daniel Ellsberg. Obama's used it eight times, including against Snowden, Kyriakos, Sterling, and others. And at the same time, we've seen Obama pass Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which overturns over 150 years of domestic law and permits, for the first time, the military to be used as a domestic police force and seize American citizens who substantially support, that's the language of the section, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or something called Associated Forces, another nebulous, undefined term, put them in military facilities, including our offshore penal colonies, and strip them of due process until, in the language of this section, the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is forever.
And I
sued the president, as you may know, in federal court over this in the Southern District Court of New York and won. And, you know, the judge wrote quite clearly that it was unconstitutional, and then the Obama administration appealed in the name of national security in the Second Circuit, rather than rule on the provision, denied my standing in the court, which was a kind of sleazy way to, by fiat, strip us of more constitutional rights. And that has been the tradition of the courts, including, of course, we can't forget wholesale surveillance, which, again, is clearly unconstitutional. So the Obama administration, because it serves corporate power, this corporate, tiny corporate oligarchic global elite, has continued that assault, the expansion of imperial power, the use of drones, the targeting and assassination of U.S. citizens, wholesale surveillance of the American citizenry. You know, all of this has remained unchecked, really going all the way back. I mean, it began with Reagan, but it was accelerated by Clinton. And at that point, it makes no difference. The Republican and the Democratic Party are equally at fault in this process.
And
you know, whether it's cynicism, whether it's powerlessness, whatever it is, this process isn't going to stop until we make it stop. And certainly Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush aren't going to do anything to halt what's happening.
And so part of this, part of what I think is disturbing, but also opens a little gap in the armor for it to be exploited, is this idea. I mean, everything you're describing is so, you know, Kafkaesque, this whole period of time, this post 9/11 existence of, you know, well, how, when's the end of hostilities, as you pointed out, you know, who is a foreign enemy when the enemy is a concept? And that's all kind of just been tidally swept into consciousness and into language to the point where, as your lawsuit pointed out, you know, language and law becomes pretty meaningless functionally. And I pulled this quote out of an interview that you recently did, and you talk about how, quote yourself to you, which can be awkward, sorry about that, says, we haven't yet moved into a period where the vocabulary we use to describe our reality matches that reality. That's always a revolutionary period because there's a disconnect between the way we speak about ourselves and the way we actually function, and that's where we are. So talking about citizenship is kind of meaningless when there isn't a functioning democracy for you to be represented by. What?
Right. Well, we venerate values and rights that no longer exist.
So what does that mean for seizing the real rights?
We live in a democratic system that no longer exists. I mean, the money has replaced the vote. The consent of the governed is kind of a cruel joke. It doesn't matter what the citizenry wants. They don't get it. You know, Wall Street, bailing out Wall Street across the political spectrum was incredibly unpopular. When they did a poll on Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, it had a 97% disapproval rating. But it doesn't make any difference anymore. It's what that corporate totalitarian state wants. And whatever they want, they get, because, quite frankly, their lobbyists are sitting in Washington or in state capitals writing the legislation. And you can render a citizenry powerless and hold up that fiction only so long before there's blowback. And there is going to be blowback. And they're preparing for it. That is why they have stepped in to strip us of our most precious constitutional rights. That is why there is wholesale surveillance. That is why they have lifted the legal constraints to use the army as a domestic police force. That is why they have militarized police forces throughout the country. They know very well what's coming, and they're getting ready.
And what leverage does that leave for people who are, you know, as the title of the book, Wages of Rebellion, you know, what, as people are getting to that breaking point, wanting to kind of make it stop, you know, kind of throw down the gauntlet, as it were, what leverage is there for people who are interested in that? And also, what role does technology play in that? I think that's one of the most interesting debates within people who are interested in discussing revolution and exploring it. You know, people either think that social media and technology is going to be our ultimate tool that works to solve everything. But it's unfortunately also the source of this, you know, spectacle that you've written about so extensively, and the conduit to all of this surveillance. So,
right. Well, I mean, the Occupy movement is a good example. So within the Occupy movement, people are communicating electronically. It's a very useful tool for organizing events quickly and disseminating information quickly. But because it's monitored completely by the state, once the Occupy encampments were physically shut down, the state knows who to go after, and they have been going after them throughout the country, oftentimes dragging them in the court on bogus charges and letting them plea out on felony convictions with the understanding that they've got 5 years probation and they can't really be activists anymore. So Julian Assange wrote a book a while ago with Jacob Applebaum and others called Cyberpunks. It was actually before the Snowden revelations, but because they're kind of savvy in terms of how the internet works, and because they were a victim of wholesale electronic surveillance, they described these systems as, you know, ultimately dystopian and ones that were being turned to create the most efficient security state. Security and surveillance state in human history, and so you know, technology isn't going to save us, isn't going to protect our liberties any more than technology is going to save us from climate change. Technology is a neutral force, and it is used to serve the ends of whoever is in control of it, and the people who are in control of it, the corporations, the fossil fuel industry, the security and surveillance industry are employing technology for forms of control. You know, we're going to have to find systems and mechanisms which, you know, whether it's through encryption, I mean, this is, you know, even Assange said encryption is a kind of temporary solution because it's ultimately going to be breached. You know, we're not going to bring about any kind of realistic change within the society sitting in front of our computer. Mm-hmm. In the end, you're just still sitting alone in front of a screen, mm-hmm. which is kind of what the state wants. It's going to come, if it comes, by pulling hundreds of thousands of people into the streets on a sustained basis.
Mm-hmm. Which
it'll come through
with
nonviolence, because we can't compete with the state in terms of violence. It will come by discrediting the system itself. That's something that I saw in Eastern Europe. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, in Czechoslovakia, and Romania. So, I mean, let's go back to East Germany, which at the time was the most sophisticated security and surveillance state on the planet. And now, of course, we've dwarfed anything the Stasi ever dreamed about. And there you had, I mean, ultimately hundreds of thousands of people pouring into Alexanderplatz, and tens of thousands of people marching through the streets of Leipzig. And at a certain point in the fall of 1989, the dictator Erich Honecker sends down an elite paratroop division to fire on the protesters in Leipzig, and they refuse to do it. And Honecker manages to hang on to power after having been in power for 19 years for another week. The same thing was true during the Velvet Revolution. So, you know, it's secret to those who are tasked with the implementation of control, the kind of foot soldiers of the elite, the police, the bureaucrats, the civil servants. They know the system's rotten. And the hope is that you can create enough defections within these ruling systems to create paralysis. As soon as these forces will no longer protect that tiny oligarchic elite, they're finished. And I would argue that most revolutions, although, you know, violence is often a part of it, but most revolutions are fundamentally nonviolent in the sense that, for instance, you had during the Russian Revolution, bread riots in Petrograd. They sent the Cossacks in to quell the disturbances, and instead of quelling them, they fraternized with the crowd. So the Tsar, who was on the front during the World War I, is put on a railway carriage, and even before he gets back to Petrograd, he has to, or St. Petersburg, he has to abdicate. So, you know, all of these New York City cops, for instance, they all, in their off time, work as rent-a-cops for, I think, $37 an hour in places like Goldman Sachs. They're watching these guys walk by in their $8,000 suits and getting in their limos. They've seen it from the inside. And I think one of the reasons that the state wanted to pass the Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act is because they don't trust the cops to protect them.
And that's part of what's disturbing. I don't want to delve too deeply into this, but the culture that we talked about earlier, this really advanced, at this point, warping of Christian notions into patriotic notions that's fully integrated into the military, you know, which is preying on young men without a functional concept of masculinity or economic opportunity. You wrote a really good article, a review, really, of American Sniper that I enjoyed reading, though it depressed me. And that, I think, is something that we should be really aware of, is the culture that the military is breeding and also creating and into this destructive feedback loop that is more, you know, I'm less likely to rely on the human sentiment left after that than I am with city police, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, that fusion or that sacralization of the state, which was also true under communism, it wasn't was its own form of religiosity, but it was this utopian, you know, vision that would be created. Yeah, it's very much part of the military now, and has very deep roots within the military. We see it in all sorts of cases that keep coming up. And at that point, you know, you marry that kind of fusion of state and military power with religious power, and you couple that with huge segments of your population which are dispossessed, and you have the perfect recipe for fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when society breaks down is that business and corporate oligarchs will make this kind of unholy and often uneasy alliance with these groups. I mean, people like Dick Cheney, for instance, probably looks at members of the Christian right as if they're lunatics. And yet, for those kinds of figures, they have to build an alliance.
Mm-hmm.
To create a kind of mechanism by which they can mobilize masses in support of what's in essence their own disempowerment, and these forces are real and they are potent within all dysfunctional societies, including our own.
Yeah. And so I think at the same time that that is a real problem, you know, that the dispossessed being vulnerable to this kind of lure of more fascist approaches, I think that there's also a lot of hope in how viral, I guess, to use the language of the internet, a lot of these ideas about, you know, about class war fundamentally out of Occupy Wall Street and beyond, and even with police violence, if we look at, you know, We Are the 99%, Black Lives Matter, I think that a more discerning or just a differently backgrounded, not a word, chunk of the dispossessed of in this country are very swayed by the concept and notion of revolution and a different kind of society.
Well, I'd be careful. I don't know that they're the dispossessed. Yeah, Occupy was largely a white movement of the sons and daughters of the middle class, college educated. And they constitute what Bakunin calls déclassé intellectuals, those whose expectations for their position in society could not be met. So they finish college, they're heavily in debt, they are working at low-wage jobs, they realize the system is not going to offer them the kind of opportunities that they once thought the system would offer them, unemployed lawyers, unemployed journalists, unemployed teachers. And Bakunin argued, unlike Marx, that these déclassé intellectuals were vital to any revolutionary movement. I think Bakunin's right, because revolutions are just not carried out by the poor. And in fact, as Marx pointed out, many of the dispossessed and poor are more easily seduced into the or mobilized in these kind of fascist or proto-fascist formations that work on behalf of the elite. So when you have a group of déclassé intellectuals, which I think Occupy kind of embodied, marrying itself to a dispossessed working class, and that would be like service workers,
mm-hmm.
and low-wage workers, then it becomes dangerous, because oftentimes within that class of college-educated disaffected, they come equipped with the kind of managerial and ideological tools that makes revolution possible. I mean, Lenin, who you know, carried out a kind of coup d'etat, a counter-revolution to create state capitalism in the Soviet Union, destroyed the Soviets and the anarchists, and was extremely prescient about how revolutions work. And although he had a kind of disdain for intellectuals, he, Trotsky, and all these other figures kind of embodied that idea of a day class, say, intellectual. So I think that we have seen the rise of that class that Bakunin would have cited as fundamental towards making revolt possible, and it has built alliances through Black Lives Matters, through Occupy, through, you know,
through
calls for
debt,
raising the minimum wage, with a beleaguered working class. And that, again, is a kind of prerequisite for successful revolt.
Mm-hmm. And I think it gives language to kind of the unspoken knowledge that all of the that section of the working class has about the situation,
right,
but hasn't been validated in the same
right
way.
Right, and, you know, Alexander Berkman writes about this, that you know, that all revolutions are invisible. It's like he compares it to a pot that with boiling water, that you only notice it at its eruption. But what's happening is that the linguistic choices that are made to describe and validate a particular system of power being discredited, and you don't see that process until the very end. And so I think when we look at the utter disconnect between now how we describe ourselves as a democracy and the reality of what's happened, as that gap widens and widens, those ideas and that language are rapidly losing their credibility. And once they've lost their credibility, these systems of power have only one thing left, and that's naked force, which they will use. But at that point, they're exposed for who they are. And I think that process is, I think you're right, I think that process is something that is well underway. Again, you know, whether you're coming out of the left, the center, or the right, the assault that Clinton really accelerated against the working class is now being carried out against the middle class. And we've reconfigured the country into a kind of neo-feudalism. You cannot, this goes all the way back to Aristotle, you cannot maintain a democracy in an oligarchic state. We live in a political configuration that Sheldon Wolin, who's probably our greatest living political philosopher, calls inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. And that in a classic form of totalitarianism, you have the rise of a reactionary or revolutionary party that takes power, assumes power, and overthrows a decaying structure and replaces the symbols and the language. But in inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized all of the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. And I think Wolin's right. That's where we are. His book, Democracy Incorporated, I never tire of recommending, is probably our most prescient critique of the American political system to date.
Great. And I just want to remind folks who are just joining us listening to the show, you're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. The program is Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and I'm talking live with Chris Hedges in advance of his upcoming appearance in Spokane to talk about this book coming out this year, 2015, Wages of Rebellion. That will be at the Bing Crosby Theater, 7 p.m. Tickets are available online if you go to peacejustice.org/hedges. I will also link to it in the Panopticon on Facebook, facebook.com/praxisradio, where for better or for worse, you can find all the content of this show for now. So talking with Chris about this very bizarre, interesting, and revolutionary moment that we are all living in, I want to back up a little bit to something we were talking about with kind of this idea of consciousness of people who have been dispossessed by the system, neglected by the system, disenchanted by the system. I know that you teach in prisons on the East Coast, and I think that's something you've been doing for quite a while.
Yes.
And what do you talk about these topics in that context? Does conversation end up going there with the imprisoned people?
Well, that's kind of all we talk about.
I can imagine.
It's the most politically conscious class in American society because they understand, because they're victims of the system, exactly how the system works. They know that the judicial system is dysfunctional. 94% of people who are convicted in this country plea out. They understand that everything is stacked against them, and that the system is designed for recidivism. 60%, 64% actually go back into the prison. They have watched every form of rehabilitation and programs taken from them. They and their families are preyed upon by corporations year after year. It gets worse, whether that's phone companies, private phone companies that charge them 15 cents a minute and exploit that need to communicate. I mean, phones are often the only way their children can speak to their fathers or their mothers or siblings to their brothers, parents to their sons or daughters. Commissary prices have again been turned over to private corporations, which have jacked up prices by 100%, although wages remain the same, roughly a dollar, a little more than a dollar a day for 8 hours of work. And you have an entire system, exploitive system, built to fleece the vulnerable. I mean, you now see people leaving prison in debt. Oftentimes, they've been in prison for decades, and they're walking out thousands of dollars in debt. Prisons are no longer issuing basic items such as shoes. You have to buy $45 pair of Nikes, yes. And you're making $28 a month. And we haven't even spoken about the court fees when they're sentenced, thousands and thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a student who was arrested when he was 14 for a crime I'm pretty certain he didn't commit, and thrown in with the adult population, given a $10,000 fine. He's been in prison now for 22 years. And he still owes $6,000. He's also not eligible to go before a parole board till he's 70. So they get it. And that's kind of, it's a very easy group to talk to because they've seen through it. And they fully understand that they are the victims of the destruction of our manufacturing base. They're superfluous to the capitalist system. Their bodies on the streets of inner cities are worth nothing to the state, but they can generate behind bars $40,000 or $50,000 a year to mm-hmm. prison contractors, prison builders, laundry companies, phone companies, and let's not forget that many of them are working for for-profit corporations for pennies on the hour. And we have major corporations, Target, AT&T, and there's a article I did called The Prison State of America that lists them, even Victoria's Secret, are exploiting this form of neo-slavery. And you have prison administrators, especially in California, that are going to corporations that hire sweatshop workers in places like Bangladesh and say, come back and use this labor. They can't organize. They'll be put in or protest their conditions. They'll be put in isolation. They always show up to work on time. You don't have to pay any kind of benefits, and you can pay them less than you're paying. I mean, a sweatshop worker in Bangladesh makes about 22 cents an hour, and a prisoner working for a for-profit corporation can make as little as 15 cents an hour.
Wow. That's bleak, but...
Well, that's, you know, prisons, you got to look at prisons because, again, like these sacrifice zones that Sacco and I wrote about, this is what is the end result of the corporate state. I mean, part of the reason we're being stripped of our rights as fast as we are is because this is kind of the perfect society in the eyes of corporate oligarchs.
Hmm. So does, in our last couple minutes here, I want to try to end on a vaguely hopeful note, not to be trite, but because I think that, as you just said, you know, it's the easiest group of people to talk to because they see it. Do you have hope or belief, whatever word you want to use, that as these interlocking crises come directly to more of us in the more cushioned regions of society, that this revolutionary consciousness and action will bloom naturally as that anger and knowledge spreads further through the social
strata? I do, but I also think that rising with it will be this kind of proto-fascism, which has always marked American history. Most violence in American history is vigilante violence used against the vulnerable, whether it's you know, the old gun thugs and the Pinkertons who were used against the labor force, whether it's the KKK and the White Knights who terrorized African Americans in Jim Crow. And that's what happens in a society. You create a kind of extrajudicial vigilante force that is not directly tied to the state but does the bidding of the state, and often brutally. And the state kind of looks the other way, and the brown shirts kind of serve this role under fascism in Germany. So, and because the left has been so weakened, because the populist and radical movements, which really opened up American democracy, and all of the openings in America in democracy came from those groups, whether it was the Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists for women's rights, the labor movement, even the civil rights movement, have been so utterly decimated that we who care about an egalitarian open society are facing a tremendous crisis at a moment when we have been terribly weakened. I take hope in consciousness. I take hope in the understanding that that it's up to us, that the system isn't going to save us. You know, we're either going to save ourselves or you know, be trapped in this kind of species of corporate totalitarianism. But I'm also not, I don't want to be naive about what we're up against.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, our hour is up, but I do hope that we can continue this conversation with more Spokane folk on the 10th when you come to town. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Yes, and thank you, and I look forward to being there.
Yeah, and you can read Chris Hedges' work both in his new book, Wages of Rebellion, but also in his weekly or close to weekly column on truthdig.com. I will post those links on the podcast, which you can find at kyrs.org. And again, tickets and information about this upcoming talk are available at www.peacejustice.org/Hedges. Thanks so much for listening. F Yes is up next. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.